just turned on, Christy?
Yes, Hillary just turned it on, so.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. This is a public rule-making hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedures Act, specifically Section 244103. The date is Wednesday, October the 4th, 2006, and the time is 1 p.m. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room at 1700 Broadway, Suite 270, Denver, Colorado. I'm Secretary of State Gigi Dennis. I'm convening this hearing in accordance with the rule-making notice procedures that were published in the Colorado Register on September the 11th of 2006. The purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's rules concerning campaign and political finance. The Secretary of State's office prepared a draft of proposed amendments to the rules that was distributed to the public and published on the office official website. A copy of the draft is available on the table in the back of the room. As stated in the notice of rulemaking, the purpose of the proposed amendments is to provide clarification and answer questions arising under Article 28 of the Colorado Constitution and Article 45 of Title I of the Colorado Revised Statutes, and to make such other amendments to the campaign finance rules as may be necessary or appropriate to administer the provisions of Article 28 of the Colorado Constitution and Article 45 of Title I of the Colorado Revised Statutes. I'd like to introduce those at the table with me today. To my right, Mr. Bill Hobbs, Deputy Secretary of State, Monica Marcus with the Attorney General's Office, Holly Lauder, the Office Elections Director, Christy Hubbard, the Campaign Finance Lead, and Stephanie Selgelski, our Legal Specialist. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. This meeting is audio recorded, and all comments become part of the official legal record. This hearing is also being broadcast over the Internet. For anyone who wishes to testify at this hearing, there is a sign-up sheet at the back, and I ask that you sign up in order to testify. If the room becomes too crowded, we do have an overflow room upstairs on the third floor, so if anyone would like to sit down, there are still some seats here in the front. Facilities are on the third floor as well. For the record, my office has received written comments on the proposed rules. All comments that have been received will become a part of the official record of this hearing. Before we begin receiving public comment regarding the proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's campaign and political finance rules, I'd like to ask Mr. Bill Hobbs to provide a brief outline of the rules under consideration for adoption. Mr. Hobbs?
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to go over the proposed rules pretty quickly, but I'm hoping that'll help focus some of the discussion. I know it's always hard when the public just sees a draft and doesn't really know the background and kind of where things come from and what they're intended to address. So I'm hoping this will be helpful. The draft that we're working from is dated September 25th, 2006. Again, I think copies are available on the table by the back. These are in the form of amendments to the existing campaign finance rules, and the amendments are presented in numerical order. But I'm actually going to skip around a little bit because it's not the most logical order. In fact, what I think I'd like to do is start at the back. And I'll bounce around a little bit, but I'm going to start with the last page and start with Rule 4.18. This rule deals with committees that have registered but don't have any activity to report during a reporting period. Our office has said, I think, for years that committees, once they're registered, even if they don't happen to have contributions or expenditures for a particular reporting period, do have to report. And However, we did have some a question from one of the committees of several months ago, I believe, about what's the basis for that. Is it in the Constitution? Is it in the statutes or whatever? And we felt like since that was our understanding of the law, we ought to write it down somewhere. So that's what that's the purpose of new rule 4.18. The preceding rule, 4.17, deals with transfers of voluntary contributions from members that are made simultaneously with dues payments. This actually goes back a number of months ago, maybe many months ago. We had some inquiries about voluntary dues paid to membership organizations. In fact, initially, I think we were asked for an advisory opinion on some questions concerning that. And we have some, we already have some advisory opinions on the subject of membership dues. And actually, if I'll just go ahead and say, Mr. Trey Rogers and Ms. Denise Hoffman actually had approached our office asking for further clarification and further guidance on that subject. And I primarily dealing with how are voluntary dues or voluntary contributions treated. And so we over a long period of time, we had some discussions with the folks that were asking as well as internally, ultimately decided that rather than doing another advisory opinion, it might be better to try to put into the rules some of what's already in advisory opinions and maybe at the same time clarify the additional questions. So 4.17 is an attempt to move in that direction and deal with voluntary dues. As I recall, and I actually haven't read the rule for a little while, but as I recall, it's pretty the approach taken is pretty much to treat voluntary contributions from members as pretty much the same as dues contributions from members, you know, to the extent that they might be used for political contributions. In either case, regardless of what they're called, whether they're called dues, which members either have to whether it's opt-in or opt-out, members have to ultimately agree that their dues are used for political contributions. But regardless of whether they're called dues or voluntary contributions, the idea would be the idea in the proposed rule is to treat them the same. Now, there's some other that's the heart of that issue is in 4.17. We had also done in connection with proposing that rule, we made what we thought was a conforming amendment or a related amendment in Rule 1.14, and now I'm going to skip to the beginning. In 1.14, we added references to voluntary contributions, consistent with the premise that the proposal in 4.17 was to treat voluntary contributions the same as membership dues that are used for political purposes. I think at least that was our intention, but I know it's caused a lot of confusion because after we made this proposal, and these rules were proposed, we issued a notice of rulemaking August 18th. And after we proposed these rules, we were sued in the Sanger lawsuit, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with, over three of the campaign finance rules, including 1.14. And that lawsuit, though, wasn't filed until 4 days after we had proposed this change. So I want to make it clear that it was not our intent to make any change to 1.14 in response to the Sanger lawsuit because we didn't know about it at the time. It was only intended to be a conforming amendment to the change in Rule 4.17. One of the things that I think would be helpful to have comment about is regardless of what people may think of 4.17, well, I guess if people think that 4.17 may be a good approach, it occurs to me that the amendment in 1.14 could be dropped. I don't think it's necessary, and it's clearly causing some confusion. So a related question is whether or not it would be better just to drop that amendment or rewrite it in some fashion. Frankly, in favor of dropping it is that it is confusing given that that Rule 1.14 currently is subject to a preliminary injunction with respect to at least some plaintiffs. So I think we could avoid maybe that confusion if we didn't amend that rule at all. And as far as I know, it's not necessary. So that's, like I say, that's part. That's why it's there anyway. That it did predate the Sanger lawsuit, and actually today's Rocky Mountain News reports that this was proposed September 25th. That's a mistake. I think it's probably based on the fact that this current draft is dated September 25th. That's what's posted on our website. But the original notice of rulemaking, August 18th, did make this proposed change. Working through the next proposal here in the draft rules is 3.8. This was an emergency rule that we adopted, I think, in July, as I recall. 3.8 and 4.16 were both adopted at the same time. They both deal with multipurpose committees. They're before us today for purposes of considering whether to make those two rules permanent. And by way of background, these rules were suggested to us from the Attorney General's office because of issues that had arisen in another lawsuit, the Independence Institute versus Dennis. The issue there has to do with the definition of issue committee and what happens when a membership organization finds itself falling under the definition of issue committee. Maybe I'll belabor the issues in that case. But the Independence Institute, because they had opposed a ballot issue, had expended a certain amount of money, arguably they fell under the definition of issue committee. And then the question arose then, when they do their campaign finance reporting, do they have to report all of their finances, the finances of the entire organization, or just that portion of their finances that related to their support or opposition to a ballot issue? Statutory law had provided that membership organizations in that situation only report that portion of their finances that's related to their campaign issue. And that appears to have been removed, I think inadvertently, and I believe 2003, I believe it was probably inadvertent in a cleanup amendment after the passage of Amendment 27. In any event, I think the plaintiff in this case, the Independence Institute case, is saying that if they have to report all of their finances, that's an unconstitutional requirement. So the purpose of the rule is to clarify that under the campaign finance law, membership organizations only have to report their campaign finances, and hopefully that will help with that litigation. So again, there's no change in 3.8 or 4.16. Those are just proposed to be made permanent. Rule 3.9 deals with anonymous contributions. This is something we've had some questions about. The type of situation that arises is somebody sticks a $100 bill into an envelope and mails it to a candidate committee. It has to be reported, and the law requires that the individual be identified, but the candidate doesn't know what the source is. So the proposed rule would say basically the candidate cannot keep that contribution since they cannot comply with the requirement, and therefore that it would have to be donated to a charitable purpose. But people may have other proposals on how to deal with that situation. Rule 4.6, the changes in 4.6, and actually I don't know whether that's 4.5 or 4.6 because it says Rule 4.6 would be amended and then it says 4.5. I suspect it's 4.5.
4.5, though.
Okay, 4.5 is what it really is. We've been getting questions during this cycle about personal loans that candidates may make to their own candidate committees, and how are they treated. The proposed changes here attempt to answer that. We actually delayed trying to answer this question because there was a campaign finance complaint that had been filed over this very issue, and we were reluctant to propose a rule until an administrative law judge had an opportunity to rule on that complaint. And that did happen. after the ALJ ruled on that case, then we proposed this rule, which is intended to be consistent with the ruling of the administrative law judge in that case. And that is, just for the record, that's the complaint filed by Kim Sayers regarding alleged campaign and political finance violations by Gene Labuda. And that decision was issued August 8, 2006. So, again, we've for the notice of rulemaking that we issued on August 18th, we've proposed this approach to personal loans from candidates that we think is consistent with what the ALJ ruled. But again, it's here for public comment. The change in Rule 4.6C is related to the same issue. There's a special rule that deals with candidates who've accepted voluntary spending limits. The changes to Rule 4.15 are sort of related to the voluntary contributions as well. The existing rules in 4.15 deal with membership organizations transferring a portion of dues to small donor committees, but in reality, questions come up not just about transfers of dues to small donor committees, but also to political committees and issue committees. And basically, the proposal here is just to expand those rules to cover all of the situations that have been coming up. And I think that covers the rules. And again, I'm hoping that at least with a little more background, it'll be helpful to folks on how you, provide some comment for us and some feedback. So,
thank you, Bill. At this time, I'll be calling upon those who are interested in testifying. We ask that when you come up to the front of the podium, that you speak into the microphone. Jenny, this morning you were a little light as far as the pickup for the internet audio. So you're going to have to kind of lean up close to the microphone. State your name and the organization in which you're representing. This hearing is scheduled to conclude at 3:30. If you could simplify your testimony by not repeating what somebody else has said, it will help speed things along. I'd just like to remind the audience as well as the press that these are only proposed rules and nothing has been finalized, and that is why we are all here today taking testimony on them. So if you have not signed up yet, you need to sign up. Rita, want to raise your hand? She'll make sure you sign up on the right paper and give everyone time to speak. Okay, is it Ernest Durland?
Duran,
thank you. I'm sorry, there's an extra line made there.
The extra mark there is signifies how much I love my father. That's a junior. Huh. Ernest L. Duran, Jr.
Very good, thank you. Welcome, Mr. Duran.
I'm a fifth-generation Coloradoan. I am president of United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 7. I represent 23,000 members throughout the state. I am also a licensed attorney. I got out of law school. I went to work at the National Labor Relations Board, the federal agency that enforces labor laws between unions and employers. And our general counsel, John Bowen, is going to speak, so I don't want to give you a preview as to what he's saying. Let me just say this. Under federal law, and it's been adopted by the Supreme Court, members have a right to opt out of paying for politics. Any money we spend for politics, there's an elaborate procedure. We send notices out every year. We do calculations every year. If we have members that do not want some of their dues money to be spent on politics, they can opt out. It's called a fee pair. We have over 700 within our local union that have opted out. By the state trying to make a state requirement that members have to opt in, that is diametrically opposed to federal law, and I think it's preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. As a citizen of Colorado and a fifth-generation Coloradoan, I would just like to say that I think this is a tremendous waste of taxpayer dollars. You changed the rule. It's gone to court. The court has found that it was invalid. My personal opinion, it is invalid. The state legislature tried to pass that rule. It failed at the state legislature. And now the courts have failed. The two candidates for the Secretary of State's office both have said they disagree with this rule, the Republican candidate as well as the Democratic candidate. And so I would ask you that you not implement these rules, do not cause more litigation, do not cause the expense of additional tax dollars on this. And Mr. Hobbs, you did a very good job of explaining all the proposed rules. I can just tell you my perspective of it, especially given the timing, given what I read in the newspaper, I read in the discovery about the previous lawsuit. This was done at the urgings of Republican attorneys. There was not a fair hearing on it done before, and this is just partisan politics. And I'm a Democrat, and I'm proud to say I'm a Democrat, and I understand you're a Republican, and that's fine. I respect that. But let's not involve the state in partisan politics, and let's not use taxpayer money to do it. You guys run your campaign, the Democrats will run their campaign, and whoever wins, wins. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duran. Hey, folks, this isn't a time to be clapping and applauding, and you know, we've got an orderly hearing to get through today, so let's make best use of the time and those who want to speak. John Bowen, good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm General Counsel for United Food and Commercial Workers. What I'd like to address very simply is what Mr. Rann already referred to, and that is the preemption of these kind of rules by federal law. Labor relations is one of those areas of federal law that the federal government has gone to great lengths to define and describe. That extends not just to picket lines and other activities, but it also extends to issues like the relationship between workers and their unions, and what union dues and funds can be expended for. Since the 1950s, the Supreme Court has held that the power and duty of primary decision in the relationship of union employees resides with the federal government, specifically the National Labor Relations Board, and that the state, quote, could not adjudge the same controversy and extend its own form of relief, unquote. And further, the courts have said that the states must decline jurisdiction in deference to the tribunal which Congress has selected for determining such issues in the first instance. I would point out that in 1988 or in 1989, the Supreme Court very specifically set forth a requirement that members be allowed to have steps to withdraw their agreement to use money for political purposes in labor unions. That wasn't new. Those types of decisions have gone back into the 1950s. And the court has described precisely what steps a union must make available to its members to withdraw its participation, the members' participation of non-voluntary use of their money. This organization, as most every other labor organization in the United States, is bound by those rules. We make it possible for members who do not want their money to be used for political purposes to withdraw their agreement to that, to challenge the percentage of their dues that are used for that purpose, and we have, as Mr. Duran already pointed out, a large number of people who we represent who do that. Those procedures were set up through the federal system. And they are precisely opposite of what this rule seems to want to do, not just 1.14, but also 4.17. And apparently, based on the explanation we've just heard, 4.15 would do the same thing. The Supreme Court says you cannot presume that the member objects, which is precisely what these rules do, and that is directly conflicting with federal law. Therefore, all of these rules would be preempted by the federal jurisdiction. The state of Colorado should not make rules that are in conflict, and if they did, they would be invalid. For that reason, we believe all of these rules should be invalid and not adopted by the Secretary as part of the election process in Colorado. I did submit a written statement which details the specific references to legal quotes, and I'm sure I hope anyone who wants to will read it. Thank you.
Thank you. Denise Hotman. Okay, Trey Rogers. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. My name is Trey Rogers. I represent the Colorado Association of Realtors, a membership organization that represents over 26,000 members in the state of Colorado. As Mr. Hobbs pointed out, I, on behalf of CAR, made a request for an advisory opinion that would clarify that a membership organization could transfer dues dollars not only to a small donor committee, but also to an issue committee or to a political committee. In that same request for advisory opinion, we asked for clarification on the point that a membership organization could accept a voluntary contribution and transfer those dollars at the direction of the member to an issue committee, a small donor committee, or a political committee. After some discussions with Mr. Hobbs and other members of your staff, it was suggested that perhaps those two changes would better be made through a rule. And 4.15 and 4.17 are the result of those discussions. Now, the way that CAR operates is that it invoices its members for dues annually. The dues are fixed, but what we would like to do is offer members an opportunity to make a voluntary contribution on that dues invoice and say, you know, I'd like to transfer X dollars to CAR's issue committees, membership committees, small donor committees. We have some uncertainty about not whether we can do that, but as to whether we would subject CAR to litigation, as it has been subjected to in the past. If we tried to do that without first clarifying that the transfer of those voluntary contributions is permissible. By the same token, we wanted to avoid litigation over the transfer of dues, not voluntary contributions, again, to issue committees and to political committees. That's all these rules are intended to do. There is certainly not the intention of CAR to revisit the Court of Appeals decision with regard to requiring membership organizations to require written permission or obtain written permission from their members prior to making transfers. I've talked to some others who are here today who have pointed out that the language of 4.15 could be clarified somewhat. It's been pointed out that the rule could be interpreted as proposed to permit a membership organization to transfer dues to any issue committee, whether affiliated with the membership organization or not. Certainly, it was not CAR's intention to kind of open a new opportunity for transferring to unaffiliated issue committees. Our intention was simply to clarify that transfers can be made to affiliated issue committees, affiliated political committees, affiliated small donor committees. So I would suggest that perhaps in 4.15, in each A, B, and C, where reference is made to small donor committees, issue committees, or political committees, that perhaps the word or words "and affiliated" would be inserted before the listing of those committees, thus clarifying the type of transfers that we're talking about. And let me just emphasize, no intention to change the Court of Appeals' recent decision, and I would agree with Mr. Hobbs that the changes proposed to 1.14 are probably not necessary to make the changes that are included in 4.15 and 4.17. Thank you.
Could I ask one question?
Please, Mr. Hobbs.
Mr. Rogers, the suggested changes to 4.15, the term affiliated, I'm not aware of a definition, but I'm guessing it would be an issue committee created by that organization.
Yes, that's right, and it may be necessary to create a definition of affiliated as well. That could be quite easily done. I should also point out, I think there's a typographical error or an omission that's been made in 4.15C. At the end of that proposed rule, there's a reference to the small donor committee. If the changes were made, it would also, I think, be appropriate to add small donor committee, issue committee, or political committee there at the end of that rule.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions? Thank you, Ms. Rogers. James Brazell. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Secretary. My name is James Brazell. I represent UNCW Local 7. I've been a Colorado native. I also want to say that I work in the field of the grocery industry. Now, I don't quite understand all the labor talk, et cetera, that's going on here. I want to speak as a grocery member. I pay my union dues, and I would suggest to you that these dues are inhibiting or would inhibit us from our monies going to these labor and political organizations in order for us to gain our status in the political field. Without this money going to our political representatives, I believe it would inhibit us greatly, and I propose that these rules would be dropped. I don't think they're necessary. And I believe that many of our members would feel the same way about this.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for coming downtown today. Rick Swain. Good afternoon.
How are you?
Good, sir. Thank you for coming today.
My name is Rick Swain, and I'm not representing anybody but myself. I'm a Colorado resident for the last 35 years, and I've been very active in politics for the last 15 years, and a member of Local 7 for 35 years. So I'm speaking in relation to them, but representing myself. For a long time, I've donated to my local candidates in my area the amount of discretionary funds that I can afford to donate to political causes, which comes down to about $10 for each candidate that I choose to donate to. But through my union, through the portion used of my political dues and the voluntary contributions I make over and above that, I am able to collectively, with my fellows, have greater influence on what comes out of the legislature to benefit my economic situation. And when you propose these rules, you are stifling that collective effort. And I would propose that you drop these efforts and be fair about this thing. Thank you.
Thank you for coming down today. Jenny Flanagan. Welcome back, Jenny.
Good afternoon. My name is Jenny Flanagan. I'm the Executive Director of Colorado Common Cause. Good to see you all again. My comments today are really not going to go into too much detail on some of these issues. I think there are some experts in the room who are going to get into more of the detail. The big concern I want to raise and highlight, I think, which has been discussed, that we're 35 days before our election. 35 days, and here we are having a extensive, I would argue, conversation about what our current rules are and the rules of the game around our election. 35 days before our election, and we are really opening Pandora's box and asking complicated questions about how to treat campaign contributions and how our election should function in our state. And I submit this is not the time and the place to do that. You know, these rules were brought up earlier this year, particularly the rules around the membership, small donor committees and such. They've been litigated. The court has ruled to enjoin those rules. They were upheld by the Court of Appeals. I know the Secretary's office has taken a position that it only applies in limited cases. I'll let, you know, the attorneys of that case make that argument. But it seems to me that these issues have been addressed and don't belong on the table today. So it's surprising to me, I think, in some senses, that we're even having this conversation on some of these rules today.
Jenny, you realize that these proposed rules are to take effect after this election. They're not intended to be enacted before the November 7th election of 2006.
all of the rules that you have proposed here today. Is that everyone's understanding in the room? Would you like to explain that to the group further?
The exception is the two rules that have already been adopted. They'd be made permanent if they're adopted after this rulemaking hearing. The question that you're raising is if the other rules are adopted, they could either be adopted on an emergency basis or on a permanent basis. And you know, there's nothing that's decided about that, but I think Secretary Dennis is saying her assumption would be that unless there is an emergency or, you know, under the Administrative Procedures Act, there is a standard that has to be met for emergency rules. They could simply be adopted on a permanent basis. Perhaps, Jenny, if you don't mind, I'm actually going to talk a little bit about the rulemaking procedure, because I know this is kind of a source of confusion, because whenever we adopt emergency rules, especially during the election season, people are wondering why that happens. But it sometimes happens because, as I said earlier, these questions arise not when people aren't filing campaign reports and stuff. They arise when people are filing the campaign reports. And under the rulemaking process, typically takes about 4 months to accomplish if the entire process is followed. And Jenny, I know you're familiar with that, but it does take that. Here, for example, in order to have this hearing today, we had to file a notice of rulemaking by the third Friday in August. And actually Saturday was the earliest we could have held a rulemaking hearing. So obviously this is the second, the third business day we could have. It's the earliest we could have. If we make these rules permanent, any of them or whatever, they can't take effect until 20 days after publication in the monthly publication called the Colorado Register, which comes out on the 10th of every month. We can't publish them in the October 10th edition because the filing deadline for that edition was last month. So they would be published November 10th, and they would take effect 20 days after that, which would be November 30th, would be the earliest they would take effect if they were adopted on a permanent basis. Again, if there's a reason why, and this is part of what people can comment about, if they feel like some of these rules need to be adopted earlier, then that's part of what we need to hear. That's just simply part of the public comment hearing. Then they can be adopted on an emergency basis if they need to take effect right away. You know, as I indicated, I think a number of these rules simply reflect the interpretations that the office has been making all along and will continue to make whether these rules are in effect or not. So I'm not sure that they need to be adopted on an emergency basis, but I think that's what Secretary Dennis is referring to.
I appreciate that clarification, but then I guess my next question for the panel is, what is the intention of the Secretary of State's office in terms of passing these as emergency rules? Has that been discussed? I mean, because it seems to me the level of interest in the public is to know the answer to that as we're having this conversation today, and I apologize for being confused myself as to what the intentions of the office and when these would apply. That's, you know, my error, apparently. But we'd like to know what the intentions of this office are.
I'm going to be a little stubborn, Jenny. I that's what we're asking for. That's the purpose of a public rulemaking hearing, in part, is advises. I mean, and I'll give you an example. I mean, a number of people have expressed concerns about the rules, that part of these rules that deal with membership contributions. Now, as I indicated, and as Mr. Rogers indicated, what I think the purpose of the proposed changes are today is to say that that members would be able to make voluntary contributions. In addition to their dues, members could make voluntary contributions that would be treated the same as their dues. They could be transferred to a small donor committee, political committee, or an issue committee. Now, I think that may be the case right now, but I don't know that it's written down anywhere. So I'm hoping people will tell us if you like that, if you like the opportunity for members to be able to make voluntary contributions in addition to their dues and have them transferred during this election cycle to small donor committees and political committees, do you want us to adopt these rules on an emergency basis, or would you rather leave things the way they are right now, have us adopt them on a permanent basis, if at all? I mean, tell us if you like the rules. and then they would take effect November 30th or later. So you're asking for prejudgment when we haven't had the opportunity to have that input from the public, and that's what the hearing is for.
So then it's my understanding the rules that would be adopted permanently today really revolve around the multi-purpose.
That's correct.
Well, on that particular issue, we think that, again, that's an important.
Ms. Marcus was pointing out that there actually will be a gap for those rules, that those two rules that were adopted on an emergency basis, because they only, under the Administrative Procedures Act, they can only be effective for 90 days. I think there's going to be a gap if we make them permanent. Again, as I said, they won't become effective until the permanent rules won't become effective until November 30th.
So there would be a gap.
Yeah.
Well, to those issues, I appreciate the Secretary's office taking those up. We think it's important to discuss them. I know that our office has talked with Monica specifically about those. We think it's a good start, but we're not quite there yet, so we would like an opportunity to talk with you further about it, not necessarily at this date, to go into it. In terms of all of the other rules, I would urge the Secretary's office not to adopt them. Again, I think these are, as we testified at the earlier hearings around these membership rules back, I think it was in June, we think that those rules exceeded the authority of this office. These are legislative issues that have been debated time and again at the state legislature, and they warrant that level of a debate. You could go through each one. The anonymous donor, again, we think that that's in conflict with Article 28. It's, you know, groups can take up to $100 in cash contributions or under $20. I mean, that's allowed. So this rule is changing that, in our opinion. So where the rules change the law, that we feel is exceeding the authority of this office in their rulemaking capacity. That is very concerning to us.
Jenny, may I ask a quick question about 3.9? So your concern with 3.9 on anonymous contributions is that it refers to anonymous contributions in any amount and not simply $20 or more.
Yeah, it's very vague. And what is anonymous? Really, where is that written in either Article 28 or 45, the word anonymous?
Meaning that the source is not identified.
Right. Again, we're creating a new law where one doesn't exist, in our opinion.
Can I follow up on that? I think I understand you to say that anonymous contributions under $20 should be allowed because Amendment 27 doesn't require disclosure of the identity of that person. And if that's the case, I think that would be a good change to this proposed rule. What I don't understand is, are you saying that anonymous contributions in amounts over $20 should be allowed?
I'm just referring to the other provision in Article 28, which allows cash contributions up to $100. So again, this is where I think that these rules are not giving are trying to create laws that don't exist, and that's the general theme I think in each of these. So we address cash contributions up to $100 in Amendment 28. This rule just broadly states any anonymous contribution is not.
And I'm still not sure I believe what I'm hearing. I think that any amount of anonymous contribution, a cash contribution, how does the receiving committee report deal with that? If it's $100 or if it's $500 in cash anonymously arriving in the mail, how should that be treated?
I think to the extent that the contribution can be disclosed, it should be disclosed.
But Amendment 27 requires disclosing the identity of the contributor. How can that be complied with? That's why we have the rule. You can't comply with it. Amendment 27 says you have to disclose the identity of the donor. And if you can't, the purpose of the rule is to prohibit people from getting those anonymous contributions. And are you saying that should be allowed? I mean, why I say I can't believe I'm hearing this is that it seems to be that would be the new favored way of providing anonymous contributions is just to provide cash. Then the donor's identity is never disclosed as Amendment 27 requires.
And I think we agree that it's important to disclose the donor, and I'd be happy again to go into it in more detail. But I feel that this is, you know, again, creating this anonymous terminology. These are, you know, terms, and it's worthy of a legislative debate, not necessarily through a rulemaking process.
So if we pass the hat around the room today, and everyone threw in a $1, but someone threw in a $50 bill, and we don't know who in the audience threw that in, how are we supposed to report it?
I think leave it to some of the other experts in the room to answer that question, and I'll defer and reserve time to respond to that, if that's okay. Again, I think it's important to be clear that some of the issues that are addressed in these rules we think go beyond the authority of this table. I think they are legislative issues, and we think that this office should take caution before overstepping those bounds in the political climate that we're in and the things that are going on.
Thank you.
And
Mr. Hobbs?
I just want to be clear. I think I'm hearing you say you're opposed to Rule 4.18 as well. And that's the rule that requires committees to report even if they don't have any contributions or expenditures.
I don't have a particular position on that. I think broadly I've addressed the concerns that we have.
I mean, again, we get these questions. In the real world, people ask us these questions, and that's been our answer. If people would tell us whether they agree or disagree, that would be helpful, especially the authors of Amendment 27.
And I appreciate your concern, and I'd be happy to provide written comments on some of these more specifically. But I guess the point I wanted to make was more broad this afternoon.
Further questions? Thank you. Scott Shires. Welcome, Scott.
Scott Shires. I work on the Campaign Compliance Center and file, I think, this reporting cycle, nearly 83 campaign reports due sometime later today. Unfortunately, most of them are already filed. I'm going to go back very briefly to the June 12th testimony. I know you said don't repeat anything said today. Regarding the communications with membership organizations, I represent a couple. I'm the owner of one membership organization. And I still find it amazing that any membership organization be unwilling to communicate on a regular basis with its members, to ask them what they should be doing and how they should be spending the money from that membership organization. So I still don't find any problem with the rules as they are being proposed. And I do understand the distinctive difference between the rules being proposed today regarding those that have been struck down by an appellate court. I can see that, but then I know I work with the rules from the Secretary of State's office a lot more than most people from the organizations here, and it's just based on the fact that I'm more familiar with them because of my day-to-day activities. I do thank you for the proposed rules on the clarification and treatment of loans as proposed. I would urge you to adopt all of them as drafted. They certainly clarify a lot of issues and questions I've had with various clients, candidates, about how to treat their money and the confusion that has existed from prior law and existing rules regarding the loans, and I think these drafts certainly clear all that up. On 4.18, regarding the continuing filing of reports, I would ask that you expand that rule to include some additional language, allowing the Secretary of State at her discretion be allowed to terminate committees that have failed to communicate with the Secretary of State's office over an extended period of time. I recognize that you now have to maintain at least two distinctive lists, those between active committees and those committees that are no longer active. Their inactivity is based on the inability to have mail successfully delivered to the registered address, to contact the registered agent, to be able to get in touch with anyone related to that candidate or that committee. That in a lot of cases, especially when a candidate loses, they tend to fail to file final reports, get to zero balance, terminate their committees, and yet they remain on the active rolls of the Secretary of State's office for an extended period of time thereafter. And just simply as an act of cleaning up your rolls of what committees are currently active suggest that you allow yourself the privilege of terminating committees that you can no longer communicate with or no longer communicating with you. My biggest concern today is about testimony you just given. I had not actually planned on testifying or saying anything today, but I have a problem with the comments provided earlier from the Real Estate Commission representative and his association asking that Rule 4.15 be amended to related committees. In the discussion between issue committees, small donor committees, and political committees, and any related committees, and transfers between those. As I currently understand the rules, we have some strict prohibitions about aggregate ownership, commonality of ownership, registered agent between various different committees, and that if a group of committees are judged to be controlled by the same entity or by the same person, that for purposes of campaign contribution limits, they will be adjudged to be one and only one committee, subject to the penalties of five times the contribution limits if a committee accepts under those circumstances contributions for multiple purposes. So that we'd have to be, would urge you to be very careful in writing and accepting related committee language in one instance where it may be in direct contradiction to other language already in the Constitution saying that we cannot have related organizations or related political committees. Otherwise, I could simply become the owner and the registered agent of all the committees in the state, and yet they would still be judged to be separate.
Okay. Questions? Thank you, Mr. Shires. Okay, that concludes those folks that have signed up saying that they did want to testify. Is there anyone else that would like to testify that has not? All right, Mr. Duran.
I would just like to add, Mr. Shires made a comment about that as owner of labor organizations that people should not be afraid to talk to their members. Well, as labor organization, we talk to our members. And let me just explain, and perhaps the Secretary does not know this, maybe perhaps you do, but let me explain it. I would like the record to reflect it. Our membership, by federal law, votes on our officers every 3 years. We have 28 people that sit on our executive board. 21 of the 28 people are people who work in the medical facilities, plants, or grocery stores we represent. They approve all expenditures, including political expenditures. In addition to that, we have monthly meetings throughout the entire state where members can attend, and they have a right to vote upon the minutes. So any action the board has taken, and these are their elected representatives, they can vote down what they have done. And so a labor organization is the most democratic organization, and I didn't want any misperception that we were not communicating with our members. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I think I'll conclude the hearing. Oh, Mr. Gruskin. Welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Madam. I have kind of broad, ample comments for the entire panel. So if I could. I would just note for the record, Madam Chair, I've listed a series of my clients in the letter. I've also listed AFT Local 858. While AFT Local 858 has not retained our firm, for purposes of making a presentation today, as you know, they're a plaintiff in the lawsuit, and I thought it would be appear incomplete if I did not list them. There are four rules that are of concern to my clients and to me. Number one is your proposed change to Rule 1.14. I think Mr. Hobbs has indicated that it may be an unnecessary, but I would suggest to you that it is an extension of the rule that the court has said, based upon the findings at the preliminary injunction hearing, there's no authority to enact. And I would suggest that elaborating upon a rule that has been determined to exceed your authority is not something that would be appropriate in light of the Court of Appeals decision. In addition, By defining voluntary contributors as members, we necessarily go outside the standard that, frankly, both the state and the plaintiffs in the action over the existing rules agreed was the appropriate standard, which is the one set down by the United States Supreme Court in Federal Election Commission versus the National Road to Work Committee. And in that case, the court specifically said people who happen to contribute to an entity for whatever purpose, a political purpose, are not members. That it has to be a more thorough relationship. It has to be, as the court said, some relatively enduring and independently significant financial or organizational attachment. So I would suggest to you that the premise of treating contributors as if they were members is inherently flawed. The court has said that is not an appropriate equation for you or for the Federal Election Commission in the earlier instance to draw. And I'm not going to ask you to do what I think is appropriate in light of the court finding, because I know that your position is well stated and on record. But I do think that in this regard, that the court's decision was thorough, and that membership organizations in the state of Colorado are entitled to know where they stand and rely upon the standards that the court set forth. And I guess what I would like to know is whether or not there is some policy basis for Rule 1.14 as amended, other than what Mr. Hobbs has said. Because if there is, we'd like that to be part of the record. And if there isn't, I haven't heard it so far from any of your witnesses, we'd like to know that as well. So I'm putting to you a question, which is there any other policy reason for enacting Rule 1.14B as amended, other than what we've heard?
No, sir.
Okay. Secondly, Rule 3.9, I think, is inherently problematic. Rule 3.9 talks about anonymous contributions. Until Mr. Hobbs' explanation, it wasn't clear to me what an anonymous contribution was. The phrase anonymous contribution has gathered its own political momentum in the last several weeks. And I suggest to you that if this regulation is adopted, it will be used for political purposes, because everyone will be entitled to interpret and read into anonymous contribution whatever they choose. Right now, and we've attached some of the things from your website, the Secretary acknowledges that contributions under $20 that are transferred are not anonymous. They're simply not itemized, and that the Constitution and the statutes authorize that. Therefore, it would seem to me that understanding the concern voiced by Mr. Hobbs about how you report that this is not an appropriate approach. It's a substantive addition to the law, and it broaches an additional problem which you may not have anticipated. It requires an act in connection with the Internal Revenue Service. It requires a tax-related act. And if the reporting organization is organized under Section 527 of the Internal Revenue Code, and these transfers reflect any significant part of its activity, the entire tax exemption for the 527 could be lost. And therefore, by mandating that these amounts be given to a 501c3 or to a charitable organization organized under 501c, you may well inadvertently be forcing 527 organizations into a position that they were never intended to be in, that is that they are taxed as corporations at the maximum taxable rate. So I don't disagree with you that the conundrum the committees find themselves in between being able to take up to $100 in cash and then having to report the name and address is problematic. It is problematic. The solution may not do much more than transfer the problem away from your jurisdiction to the federal jurisdiction, and in fact carry a much greater penalty than under-reporting of a $100 contribution. If you are determined to do something in this regard, it seems to me that anonymous ought to be made clear in terms of being a cash contribution, and a cash contribution in excess of the amounts that can go unitemized, and that some additional reporting in terms of the event and the date where this amount was taken would be provided as part of the report to you. But I would suggest to you that the regulation as drafted is clearly problematic. And I would also suggest to you that it is so vague that it will never really, absent additional definition, which I'm guessing 34 days out you don't have time to put together, will never really be helpful to the electorate.
Mark, can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
I appreciate the information about the tax implications and so forth. That's very helpful. But apart from drafting considerations, what should be done? I mean, our assumption was that since the candidate committee that receives this cannot comply with Amendment 27 by itemizing the contribution, that they can't keep the contribution. Otherwise, there would be an incentive to actually do that very thing. So just fundamentally, what should be our answer when that happens? What should happen to the contribution?
Well, I'm going to sound like taking the easy way out. Probably is, but I agree with Ms. Flanagan. I agree that it's a problem. And I agree that there's somewhat of an internal conflict in Amendment 27. It clearly permits a candidate to take that contribution. If Amendment 27 permits a candidate to take it, the secretary cannot prohibit the candidate from accepting it. There may be reporting obligations that you can impose, but you cannot do, or you cannot prohibit, what Amendment 27 permits. And so I think your question is an appropriate one, but I think it's probably one that's more appropriate for a legislative debate, because the level of reporting that would be required if you get that $100 in a fishbowl is pretty problematic. I mean, what are you going to be able to report? Well, not very many things. But I think that to the extent that you can at least identify when it came in and what the event was, and maintain internal records to the extent that you have people, a list of people who were at a particular event, maybe that kind of gets, in terms of what is consistent with the secretary's existing authority, maybe that gets you farther along the course. But you cannot say that the voters didn't mean for people to accept those contributions. They may have meant for those contributions to be accepted subject to conditions about reporting, but I don't think that you can force campaign to turn that money over to some third party entity.
Well, and again, let me follow up a little bit with a slightly different angle. I mean, Amendment 27 authorizes that, but it also requires reporting, itemized reporting as to source and so forth. And that's in the Constitution. And if they can't comply with that, I mean, the obviously the premise of the rule is then they can't accept the contribution. That's a constitutional requirement that we're trying to implement. And I don't know that the legislature can answer that. I don't know, because this is in the Constitution, how can the legislature adopt a rule that amends the Constitution?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The legislature can't. But if the legislature can't, then the secretary can't either.
Well, the secretary is granted constitutional rulemaking authority.
I
mean, and necessary for the administration and enforcement of this constitutional provision. And it seems like we have an administrative problem. People ask us, what do we do with this? And we have apparently an obligation under the Constitution to answer that.
Well, let me suggest to you, let's assume for a second that you're right, that the secretary's authority is broad enough that Rule 3.9 can be adopted. Who says that giving it to a charitable organization is consistent with what the people intended? I don't know. It could be. But I don't know, and I don't think, frankly, anybody at that table knows. So I think it's got to be part of a broader debate. Is that more appropriate than turning that $100 bill over to the state of Colorado? I don't know. But I just don't think that this is the forum for deciding that. I don't think, obviously we haven't seen exactly eye to eye on a different issue. But this is one where the people said, it's okay, take the money.
But they didn't say that. They said it's not okay. It has to be itemized, and they can't do that. They can't accept the money and itemize it.
I actually, in terms of the disclosure requirements, all Article 28, Section 7 does is refer to the reporting responsibilities for other committees.
That's true.
So in one instance, they're very specific. And in one instance, they point to the provisions currently in law. You know, we're dancing on the head of a pin here. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to your question. I don't think there is an answer to your question, except this. I don't think that you can pass this rule.
Well, and again, we talked about, actually, so the candidate committee where this came up that I'm familiar with, and I think other questions have come up, the candidate committee did give us the money. And we in fact, I think we might have even tried to send it on to the state treasury as unclaimed property, to tell you the truth. It's easy for people to say we shouldn't adopt this rule, but I'll repeat this: in the real world, this is happening. People are asking us, and whether or not we have a rule, we have an obligation to tell people what they ought to do. Should they send it to us and we give it to the state treasury? Should they give it to a charitable organization? I mean, in the real world, we have a duty to answer those questions, whether or not we write down the answer.
I hear you. I would suggest to you, though, that part of the answer is knowing how much you can say. And it seems to me that, for instance, could the secretary require that you keep a list of the time, date, and place where all of your cash contributions came in? Seems to me that's reasonable. And if you find that at an event you get 50 $100 cash contributions, is that going to raise some eyebrows? I think it is. If you create enough of a paper record that allows people to ask the appropriate questions, I think the secretary's done what she's obligated to do, which is further the purpose, the reporting purpose of that act, of the constitutional amendment. I'm not belittling the concern. I understand the concern. I get questions like this myself. There are some of these questions that have no great answer. But it seems to me that sometimes you still, even for those questions that have no great answer, you have to stay within the bounds of what you know the Constitution says. I didn't think we'd talk that much.
Sorry.
That's all right. I do think, though, that given the verbiage lately over what is an anonymous contribution, if this rule were to be passed as an emergency rule, I could see an extraordinary amount of political havoc being wreaked. And therefore, I ask three things. Number one, I ask that you not pass the rule. Number two, if you're going to pass the rule, do not pass it as an emergency rule. And number three, if you decide that I'm full of it on one and two, people need to know what anonymous means and make sure that anonymous doesn't conflict with what's already permitted. All right, Rule 4.15. I understand or have recently understood Mr. Rogers' concern. And while I appreciate that, it seems to me that the issue of transferring membership dues for issue committees is not something that is directly addressed by Article 28. Article 28 talks about transferring membership dues for political committees and for small donor committees. But currently, where membership organizations make contributions in issue campaigns, they do so in the name of the organization. And that is appropriate, and there is no concern about it. And it's particularly appropriate, and there's no concern, because there's no penalty for how much you can give, and there's no limitation on who can give. And so I think that that really doesn't become much of an operational issue. I'd also suggest to you that there is already a safety net, and that's your Rule 417, which deals with multipurpose issue committees. Currently, if someone gives an earmarked donation to a multipurpose issue committee, the name of the individual is the name that's reported as the contributor. And if they give money just generally to the organization, then the organization that contributes to its own issue committee purposes is the contributor. That's the same rule that ought to apply here. There's no reason to somehow carve out what membership dues are, how they're otherwise treated, and give them the same treatment for issue committees. And therefore, I would suggest to you that you are creating something of a Pandora's box. I think that cliche has already been used, so what is it when you overuse it already existing cliche, but I've just done it. There is no good reason, and in fact, you're creating significant problems, because there are plenty of people, and the Independence Institute case is an example, who pay into an organization who don't earmark their contributions. Under 417, however, you had changed the mission of organizations. And excuse me, I think my earlier reference to the multipurpose issue committee, I think I said 417C, but I meant 416C. Under 417, you have taken a membership organization and given the members the right to designate them as their agent for passing on contributions to any small donor committee, to any political committee, and to any issue committee, including one that may be inconsonant with the purposes of the membership organization. Believe me, if we learned anything in this trial, it's that membership organizations have their hands full as is. You do not want to make them the processing agent for someone else's contributions that have nothing to do with the major mission of the entity. In addition, it seems to me that in 417C, where you say the transfer of membership dues or voluntary contributions from a membership organization to an issue committee shall be considered a contribution from the member, is problematic. Even the language on behalf of an individual member, I'm not sure I understand. Is that they have to designate it and tell you that this is my contribution to the Yes on 46 campaign? I think that that changes inherent. If what's intended is only to take earmarked contributions, then you ought to say that. But in any event, I don't think you want to do that. Currently, we treat an organization's contribution as that of the organization. I haven't heard any testimony today that says that ought to be any different, that individuals need to be listed when they're filling out their dues application as the contributor on an issues committee. Is it important that 500 people are listed for $10 or that the organization is listed for $5,000? In terms of the impact, in terms of the information provided to the electorate, I would suggest to you that the knowledge that an organization is giving $5,000 is a lot more relevant than making it appear that 500 unrelated individuals have each given 10. And if the purpose here is to provide education to the public, it seems to me that 417 is not a step in the right direction. There may be a way to address Mr. Rogers' concerns, but I would agree with Mr. Hobbs. I would suggest to you that it is already the practice that membership dues can be transferred as well as voluntary contributions, as long as for a small donor committee you don't go over $50 and for a political committee you don't go over $500. There is no limitation in existing law. I frankly think this is a solution in search of a problem. And to the extent that there's case law out there on any of these issues, I would rely on the case law, because administrative law judges can go on and on for pages and address issues in a three-dimensional way, in a way that you really can't with a regulation. And what you don't want to do, and I know it's not your intent, is to send signals that maybe are misperceived. Lastly, I know that there was a stipulation in the lawsuit as to Rule 113 on volunteer activity, and I appreciate the Secretary's posting of that stipulation on the website. It seems to me that because that issue has been in the public eye, it would not be inappropriate to draft a regulation that would make that activity clear. And I agree with Ms. Flanagan. It seems to me, I can only imagine how many other things you have to do in the next 34 days and then beyond, and that these issues, while they're important issues, aren't issues that have to be acted on in order for us to have an order. So I thank you for taking our written comments. If you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer.
Monica?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gruskin. He needs to sign up on a regular piece of paper.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Kevin Schneider, please come forward. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Secretary and esteemed panel members. My name is Kevin Schneider, and I represent United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7. I see there are a number of people in the audience today, and the purpose of this rulemaking hearing is to get input from the public. Yet there weren't very many people on the list to speak. There's been a number of eloquent speakers prior to me voicing many different opinions. But for the most part, the majority of the room hasn't spoken, and that concerns me somewhat. So with your permission, I would like to do a raise of hands so that the panel may see from a general perspective up front what the feeling of the room is.
Kevin, we're not going to go there. We're here to take testimony. It's interesting, the passion of campaign finance. When we had a hearing this morning specifically regarding to the election rules, and we have six people show up and two testify. So it's just whatever, you know, seems to bring people to the room for the passion of the moment. So
you're opposed to having the room demonstrate to you how they feel?
I think that we've gotten more than a clear message from those that testified on where the sentiment is. So, but thank you. It was a very thoughtful idea.
You're welcome.
All right. Is there anybody else that would like to testify? Mr. Hobbs?
Mr. Rogers, I wonder if I could ask you a follow-up question based on Mr. Gruskin's comments. Would you mind? Because I'm wondering if, well, in general, if you'd like to respond, and in particular, what you think about dropping issue committee altogether from that proposal.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Hobbs. I think what I didn't hear Mr. Gruskin respond to is my suggestion that perhaps we insert the term affiliated or something of that nature before issue committee to clarify that what the rule addresses are transfers not to no 142, but to an affiliated multi-issue committee. I think that would solve at least one of the problems that Mr. Gruskin pointed out. I would not be in favor of with removing issue committee from 4.15 and 4.17 as proposed. I think it's an important clarification. And again, my client has been through litigation on this very issue, where there was a transfer to essentially a holding account, and then a transfer was made from that holding account in the name of the members who made the contributions onto other committees. The allegation of the party that filed that objection was that was a contribution from the Carr committee, not from the individual members. I also note that Mr. Gruskin pointed out we can rely on that precedent. We're not comfortable doing that. It's a single ALJ decision, maybe followed by another ALJ or a higher court in the future. It may not be. But my client would like to have the certainty that comes with the rules as proposed and as I hope adopted by the Secretary.
What if we had a special rule for issue committees and instead of including them in this rule, we had a separate rule that said that members' contributions to support or oppose ballot issues would be treated not as contributions from each member, but instead could, in fact, be transferred by the membership organization as the contributor or something along those lines.
I think that option is probably available under current law. I think a membership organization could do that today, could make a transfer of its funds, general funds, dues funds, voluntary contributions, whatever, to an issue committee without restriction. So I'm missing your point, I don't see that kind of a rule would have much of an effect.
And maybe because I might have missed your point, or Mr. Gruskin's or both, but I thought basically he was saying that is the law, but I thought you were expressing some discomfort of just leaving it unspecified by just simply removing issue committees from this rule.
Well, I think there are two issues here. The first issue is what can a membership organization do in terms of contributing to No 142? And I think, I think that's pretty clear under 28. The membership organization can make that contribution without limit. There aren't any restrictions on to speak of on source or amount of contribution to issue committee. So I'm not sure that a rule just restating mm-hmm. what 28RE provides would be helpful. The second issue is, can a membership organization accept contributions, voluntary contributions or dues payments from its members, and transfer those dues payments or voluntary contributions to its own issue committee so that the issue committee could then advocate for or against issues? And that, I would submit, is somewhat less than crystal clear in current law. Because 28 does speak to the handling of dues, tells us what we can do with respect to small donor committees, but doesn't tell us what we can do with respect to transfers to issue committees. So there is some vagueness in 28 on that point.
Okay. Thank you. Good.
Okay, Christy, did you have a question?
I did have a question, not for Trey, for either Jenny Flanagan or perhaps Mr. Gruskin regarding their opposition to the anonymous contributions. One of the things that is in Article 28 is that there are some prohibitions that are established. For example, corporations cannot contribute funds to a candidate committee. Another prohibition is that a natural person can't donate more than $50 to a small donor committee. And our office has been struggling with how do you determine if either of those things have occurred, if this is anonymous cash contribution that has come in the fishbowl that has circled the event. And I wondered if either of you would like to respond to that.
Hi, Jenny Flanagan, Common Cause. I don't know that I have much more to add other than I think as Mark sort of gave as an example of one way to deal with it by requiring a disclosure and the date and time of that specific cash contribution to try to capture that information in that type of a way. The amendment, I mean, as I read it, it really only refers to this cash contribution in currency rather than in a check, obviously, because that would have that information on it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. May I ask a question?
Stephanie?
Ms. Flanagan, I'll ask you to stay, or Mr. Gruskin, either. My concern is, in the spirit of Amendment 27, which is to disclose to the voters as they voted on it, and here we have a situation where we cannot disclose, or the candidate committee cannot disclose. In helping to clarify that, to help get the information to the voters, would it be more comforting if we were saying you receive a cash contribution over $100, so that it's not using the term anonymous, it's taking it past the $100 that is in the Constitution? Because the concern is, what if somebody drops a packet of $1,000 at a candidate's office? Okay, so you could potentially have a corruption issue if many people start doing that. Not that that's the reality of the situation, but if they did, so now all of a sudden you have all these contributions on, you know, October 3rd, I got $1,000 dropped at my doorstep. October 4th, I got the same thing. You know, because you're now throwing out contribution limits. $1,000 is probably too much to say, but if you pick a number that's within the contribution limits even, I mean, would you feel better? And Mr. Gruskin, I understand your point of there is no good way to handle this, but in the interim, we've got people and understanding that this rule would not take effect until after the November election, but there are people asking, and so we want to know. I mean, public and comment hearing is so we know what the general consensus is. What is the best way to handle it?
My family, the best way to answer a hard question is to not answer it. I think, you know, I understand the conceptual issue, and I understand that it's probably been raised by at least one candidate. But in terms of anonymous contributions, you have a much bigger issue that has, in fact, been raised. You have LLCs whose members are undisclosed, who are funneling money into campaigns using multiple LLCs and using the cover of the LLC organization. Whereas under federal law, the amounts are traced back to the individuals so that this problem doesn't happen. So I hear you about What if somebody drops $55 on three consecutive days in a campaign headquarters? I think you got a much bigger issue, which is that you have an organized attempt to conceal donors using the LLC format. And I think that's probably the bigger problem, which, frankly, you could have addressed either legislatively or through regulation by requiring disclosure of the names of the individual members of the LLC. The other thing that would do is to ensure that you don't have corporate members of LLCs who are channeling corporate dollars in violation of the Constitution. Okay, now I've used my family's way of dealing with your question. I think that to the extent that you, it's like any other law enforcement activity, to the extent that you see suspicious things going on, there's going to be investigation. There's significant subpoena powers obviously associated with these complaints. I think the Secretary has ample investigatory powers should she choose to use them. I mean, under 6.1, you can certainly ask the question, and if you're not satisfied under 6.2, you can file a complaint, and then you get to use those investigatory powers. Having been through a couple depositions recently that made people a little uncomfortable, I can tell you that there's a lot of information to be had. If you have a single individual doing this and not telling anybody, it's probably almost impossible to discern. I understand that. But so far, I haven't heard of any organized attempt to kind of make that happen. So it does need to be addressed. It does need to be addressed prospectively. It probably needs a broader debate. And we really need to flesh out so that we know the extent of the issue, exactly how prevalent it is. Because something like the LLC thing, we know that there are thousands of dollars involved. This one, do you really have an idea of kind of what we're talking about in terms of the amount of money that come into campaigns and caches?
We get questions fairly regularly, at least several times a month, from various committees and other organizations that have these fundraisers and events, wondering what they do with these, because they don't, you know, $100 has been dropped in the fishbowl, and how do they know if it's permissible for them to accept that? And I can't give you a dollar figure, but I can tell you our staff does receive those questions on a regular basis.
Well, in that regard, let me ask you this question, because you kind of used the trigger word. If somebody is in that situation and they've got money that they've got cash that they can't attribute, when they sign their oath as the registered agent that it comes from a permissible source, how do they do that? I mean, how do you sign that oath now that that's part of Rule 4.15 that it's come from a permissible source?
And perhaps I'm misunderstanding, but I believe that one of the reasons we're proposing this rule is to officially say that anonymous contributions, when you don't know who that donor is, would not be permissible. Because that's a very good point. One of the things we see is, how do you know if they haven't exceeded a contribution limit?
I absolutely get that. I'm just saying, I think my starting point is you don't have the authority to prohibit what the Constitution permits. So I think what we've been talking about is what is the appropriate stopgap. It's clearly not a very good one. But I think that, let's put it this way, there are two jobs that I would hate to have in this election season. One is the Secretary of State, and the other is a registered agent for any committee. You know, for that very reason, in terms of the registered agent issue, people are in betwixt and in between, and it's going to be tough.
Thank you. Okay. That concludes today's hearing. We will be accepting public notification or comments, written comments, through tomorrow, close of business day at 5 o'clock, tomorrow, Thursday, October the 5th. And the time is 2:30. Thank you all for coming today.